From CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, this is UBC Arts on Air. I'm your host, Ira Nadell. Each week, we feature the ideas and stories of students and staff within the Faculty of Arts at the University of British Columbia. This evening, Alfred Hermida of the UBC School of Journalism, where he teaches digital journalism, social media, and new forms of storytelling. Alf, welcome.
Thank you, Ira.
Well, I want to begin with your career and the switch, as I like to refer to it, from, I think, 16 years at BBC to academia. How did this happen, and was this part of a long-term plan, or you woke up one day and said, enough?
Well, it's interesting because when I was at college and contemplating what do I do next, there seemed various interests. I was interested in writing, interested in current affairs, interested in my background at college was international relations. So one of the things I considered was, oh, would I go into academia? I had professors who taught but were also in the field doing research. But I was drawn more towards the journalism side. I think at that time I was young. I wanted to live in the now. So that drew me to journalism rather than academia. While at the BBC, I sort of worked all over. I did local radio, regional television, national news, 4 years as a correspondent in the Middle East, helped launch the BBC News website. And what happens in journalism is at a certain point you think, well, what next? What happened around 2005 is I had the opportunity to do a Knight Wallace Fellowship at the University of Michigan. So it was the first time really in 20 years that I stopped doing journalism. And when you're a journalist, it's hard to imagine not being a journalist. It's a very all-consuming profession. And I stopped, and I found I didn't miss the day-to-day, but I relished the chance to take some courses, to do some research, to really investigate what was happening to the media, take a step back and say, well, there's this thing called the internet, and people are turning to it for the news. We have things like the BBC News website, remarkably popular. Let's take a step back from doing the job to actually studying what is going on and trying to make sense of it.
So you didn't feel a loss. You didn't feel when you were stepping away from journalism, which I sense is completely defined by action as well as language, you didn't miss that.
I didn't miss the day-to-day. And what I relished was the chance to really take time to look at something in depth. In journalism, occasionally you get to do that, but most of the time you're working to hourly, daily, maybe weekly timescales, but not really the chance to really take a step back and look at it in detail. But what really made the switch for me was I went to a conference at the University of Austin. It's the International Symposium of Online Journalism. And what they do, which is unusual in conferences, is they bring together journalists and academics. And what I found, this was in 2005, is the journalists had all these questions, struggling to make sense of this thing called the internet. And you had academics who were studying it but had no background in journalism. And there seemed a real disconnect. And that's really when it clicked for me, saying, well, maybe there's a role for me here. You know, having the background in journalism but then having an interest in the research and academic side of it.
That's fascinating. But emerging, I think, between the journalists and the academics, we have the new media, the social media. And so did you sense early on that this would be the connect, perhaps, between one world and another world?
Well, I certainly thought that going into academia, I didn't want just to publish research papers for my fellow peers. I did see an importance here in not just doing that research, but also making it accessible to the public. You know, I've been blogging since 2004, but really started properly around 2005, 2006. So one of the things I did when I started at UBC in 2006 was really pay attention to my blogging as a way of reflecting what I was studying, what I was coming across, and make it much more broadly accessible, particularly to the profession. There are not many journalists who subscribe to academic journals, not many journalists who have time to go through an 8,000-word article, yet very often there's real gems that can help them in practice.
Yes, I can understand that. So this takes us to your wonderfully titled new book, Tell Everyone. And in it, you emphasize repeatedly that the news has become a shared experience, and the news is a social experience. So how do you explain this? What do you mean by that?
Well, when I look at what was happening with social media, I think very often when we read about it, it's all about the technology, it's all about the tools. We sort of get carried away by the shiny stuff. And really, it's not really a story about technology. It's really a story about us, about how we communicate and about how the way we communicate is changing. And what struck me in researching Tell Everyone was that in some ways we were going back to the way we shared news in the past. So in the book, I write about how people in Paris would get together in salons, the intellectuals of the day would get together to compare notes, to say what had they heard, what did they think was true or not true, and collaboratively they would come up with, here's the news from the court of Louis XV. Here's the latest rumors that we've kind of confirmed about a mistress. Here's spending on military adventures. This would be written down and then sent to their friends in the countryside so they could hear what was happening in Paris. And for the common man and woman, it was in the parks, where, again, people would come together, compare notes, and try to make sense of what was going on. And when I look at what happens then through on places and spaces like Facebook or Twitter, we see the same thing. People coming together saying, I've heard this. This is what somebody's told me. Here's my own experience. Here's how I'm reaction. Here's my perspective on this. And collectively, we're doing the same thing. We're telling the story together.
But you seem to push it quite far, because you say it's become commonplace for people to share their own experiences. So when I read that in the book, and as you developed this as a theme, my first thought was, what happened to privacy?
Well, privacy is being shifted in terms of how we define it. Traditionally, privacy is the right to be left alone and control what people know about you. But increasingly, I think, especially for the younger generation who grew up with these technologies, for them, they don't go online. They don't go on Facebook. They just are online. They just are Facebook. It's all media. It's the world they're in. And they sort of cross between print, radio, television, online. It's all media.
Well, I can accept that. But aren't there certain things that we still want to keep to ourselves or to a very close family group or an intimate circle that I don't want to put out there?
And that's what we do. But sometimes what happens is we assume that what we're sharing on Facebook to a group of friends is private, yet we're doing it in a public space. So privacy doesn't come by not telling people your secrets. Privacy comes through obscurity, because there are so many millions of people on Facebook, or there are 500 million tweets a day. Why would anybody look at my tweet out of those 500 million, unless they were interested in me already? So really, it's less about controlling information and rather about hiding in the crowd, hiding in this obscurity.
Obscurity is a very interesting concept, and I know you developed this quite a bit, but my sense of obscurity is not so much hiding as creating a condition or a complexity where you can't understand what it is I'm doing. It's obscure.
And that's both a curse and a blessing, because the danger there is that you have something that's out there that's intended for a certain audience to be understood and interpreted by that circle of friends, but yet somebody from the outside could see that. You could have this unintended audience, this invisible audience, and they will take that message out of context and misinterpret what you say. So in the book, I tell the story of Paul Chambers a few years back. He tweeted out his frustration at being delayed in an airport, and he said if he couldn't get on the next flight, he would bomb the airport. He saw it as a joke, the sort of thing you might say at a bar with friends talking about your very frustrating journey. But police at the time had to take it seriously because it was a bomb threat. The context wasn't there. Now, since then, we've learned that actually when people say a lot of this stuff, we miss the intonation, we miss the context, and we need to take a step back and not just look at the words, but try to decipher the intention behind them.
Certainly, and I would refer that to context, to a sort of contextual sense of what it is. Okay, you also say the news is now. What's that mean?
Well, I mean, we've switched from a media system where news came in these discrete bundles at certain times of the day. Certainly, when I started in journalism, I would pick up the newspaper in the morning, maybe listen to the radio, and then catch up, maybe at lunchtime, but usually in the evening. It was very organized. we've had a switch towards 24-hour news, and then the internet, and then social media, and then Twitter. So really, news is happening all around us all the time. And you've seen this shift in news patterns. When I was at the BBC website, we knew our peak times. One of our peak times was lunchtime. So stories had to be up by noon, because what would happen now is people didn't wait till the evening supper hour show to get the news. They would sit at their desks with a sandwich, go to the BBC and say, what's new? What do I need to know now?
Tell me, right? Tell me.
Tell me. Tell me what I need to know.
But this raises some issues, particularly with everyone believing they are a reporter or they are a journalist. And so what happens to the news, A, as a result of that, and B, is it curated anymore? Is it filtered? What happened to the professionally trained journalist? What role does she have in this whole picture?
I would say it's less that everybody sees themselves as a journalist, but that rather you have the ability to do an act that is a fragment of journalism, is a piece of journalism, but not the whole story. It might be through taking a video. It might be through sharing a picture. It might be through selecting a news story to share with your friends, where you are taking the editorial role of the New York Times front page editor. They're not deciding what your friends see. You're deciding by saying, out of the New York Times, I think this story that was buried on page B5 is worthy of your attention. I don't think necessarily that's a bad thing, because certainly in news and journalism, traditionally you had decisions made by white men of a certain age. And of course, then the agenda would reflect the interests of those white men of a certain age. We've had changes in terms of gender and diversity, but this opens us to a wide range of perspectives and diversity. I think the issue here is not, is it good or bad, but how can we make smart decisions when we look at the news through social media? That's really one of the things I try to get at the book, that we need to understand that social media is not like print. It's not like television. It's not like mainstream media. It has its own rules. It has its own ways of working. It has its own ways of encouraging us to take certain behaviors. If we understand how it works, then we can be smart, not just about how we share, but also how we evaluate and then recommend the material that's coming at us.
Is news coming to us through social media reliable?
Is news coming through us through 24-hour cable news reliable? We could ask the same question. If you look back in journalism studies, there's a long history. Journalists make mistakes all the time. So it really is the wrong question. The real question is, how can we make decisions and evaluate what we're seeing? In some ways, we're all becoming editors. We all need the editorial skills that I teach my students in class. And really, this is one of those shifts where if we are taking on that role of editors, we need to be able and have the literacy to evaluate the information we're getting.
But there seems also to be a bit of a business side to news and social media. Can you explain that or elaborate that a bit?
Well, social media is not just about, it's not something that just affects the news business. It really is affecting industries where we need to communicate. And certainly in the world of business, in the world of commerce, this has been one of the shifts where consumers now have tremendous power to affect the perception of a brand or a product. And this really affects industries where you don't have the ability to try before you buy. In the book, I talk about how Hollywood has been affected by this. Hollywood depends on a big box office at the weekend to make most of its money. That's why we have the big advertising campaigns. All these trailers pushed us, come out on a Friday, on a Saturday, on Sunday, because that's where they make the bulk of the profits. Of course, what happens now is most film, 140 character film reviews come out at 10:30 on a Friday evening. Most of them come between Friday and Saturday morning. So instead of having that window at the weekend where you wouldn't find out whether the film was good or bad on the Monday, you have essentially one night. And suddenly your very consumers can trash your movie instantly and suddenly have your revenues plummet on the Saturday. So Hollywood has had to adjust to a world where that immediate review can affect their bottom line. And the way they've done that is by saying, well, if social media can be used to spread reviews that are going to affect us, how can we use social media to mobilize our core fans so they start building up buzz? So even if the movie's a bit so-so, those core fans will tell their friends and get them out to go and see this movie, even if it's a bit of a not quite a great movie.
Yes, I'm thinking that we almost now have pre-reviews. So before the movie is fully released, there are YouTube trailers, there are clips, there are interviews with the actors, there are press releases. And I see this happening in music as well, with albums just before they're being released. For 1 week, I can hear the entire album on NPR. That's astonishing.
Well, what they're trying to do is get people who are dying to listen to that album, who are dying to see that film, to get excited and ahead of release start talking about it. So, you know, you get this with screenings for fans. So the fans are very forgiving. So you may be a Star Wars fan, and we know that some of the Star Wars prequels have not been as good as the original set. But if you're a Star Wars fan, you're going to be excited because you've had a chance to see it before anybody else. So even if the movie is not quite what you expected, you're going to be so excited that you were picked and selected to talk about it. It's going to override any critique of it because you'll be thankful for seeing it first.
Yeah, value recedes in the background and the experience takes over, you might say.
The experience, and also that you've been selected. You've been acknowledged as a Star Wars fan and given the opportunity to experience this before anybody else.
So briefly, what follows Tell Everyone? In other words, what do you see as the next step, perhaps, in this new or not so new function for social media and the news?
Well, I think one of the things that we sort of get distracted about is by looking at the numbers of people who are active on social media. And really, I think that that's not necessarily a good metric, because even though only a fraction of the population are on Twitter, it depends who's on Twitter. So journalists pay attention to Twitter, celebrities are on Twitter, sports athletes are on Twitter, institutions use Twitter. So actually we're seeing those institutional elites using that medium. And certainly people who are connected and interested in the news are much more likely to be on social media. So we all know somebody in our social circle who always seems to know stuff. You know, they just seem to be really well connected. Now, those are the people that are on social media. And often when we talk about social media, sometimes when we talk about social media, we talk very much about the broadcasting, the transmitting, the messages being sent out, and less on the listening, on who is reading and paying attention to these messages, and how they then influence decisions by the media in terms of what they cover, or even politicians, how they react. So really paying more attention to what is happening in the listening stage of social media, as this just becomes part of the media landscape. It just becomes part of how we get our news. On Facebook, most people don't go to Facebook for news. They stumble across it by accident. And that's quite remarkable in terms of a change in behavior. And as we see these tools and technologies become part of the media space, it really does force us to examine how you find the news, who's choosing what news is important, who tells you not what to think, but what you should think about.
So do you think mainstream sources are changing, but I have the impression they recognize they're being forced to change. Otherwise, people will just bypass them entirely.
And what you see is that mainstream sources still have tremendous impact through social media, because the systematic structural power they have through being the Globe and Mail, through being CBC, translate into social media. The difference is that people on social media, through their individual actions, can choose to elevate certain voices that are not the established elites. So it becomes much more of a contested media space, where some of the power that these elites bring in from the outside is negated by the network and by people themselves choosing, I want to listen to this person. I want to watch these videos on YouTube by this person. We've seen the rise of YouTube celebrities who have millions and millions of followers, millions and millions of views, all through YouTube. They didn't have the institutional blessing of a big brand like CBS, ABC, the CBC. They rose through the choices of hundreds of thousands of individuals.
So what do you think Walter Cronkite or Edward R. Murrow would have to say, or how would they respond, or Huntley Brinkley, to these developments? Do you have any thought about that?
Well, it's interesting because it's almost, you know, with Walter Cronkite, he used to say, you know, that's the world, that's the way it is. You know, essentially, I am telling you what you need to think about. I am the voice of authority. And yes, there was value there, but also in journalism, you make hundreds of decisions of what not to include. There are so many stories, yet we only focus on a handful. And now what we have is, instead of a handful of anchors telling us this is what you should pay attention to and this is how you should think about it because of the way journalists frame the news, we have this alternative contested space where other voices can rise to the fore and say, actually, this is something we should be paying attention to, and the story isn't what you're hearing from your anchor, but actually it's happening over here.
Well, I think you've really been extremely articulate in describing this groundswell and change, most importantly, the change and transformation. And I want to thank you for joining us this evening on UBC Arts on Air. The new book is called Tell Everyone. It's fascinating, I must say. It really is. I learned a great deal. And I hope listeners stay tuned for further remarkable personalities from the Faculty of Arts at UBC. Thanks again, Al.
Thank you.